Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, August 22nd, 2001. In the fireside room this morning is Catherine Cummings Bond. Today's session number is CUC 2001-03, and it's titled Eleanor Roosevelt, Women of Strength and Courage. Let's listen in.
Storyline from are more there's a series out about women of achievement with lots of pictures I found. So if I aim at a lower level than the adult books, I've read the adult books, but for the storytelling purposes,
yes.
A little more junior high level.
Sure.
And there's tons of books. I mean, unlike Sojourner and Harriet, we know everything. We know when she went to the bathroom, Eleanor Roosevelt, because everything was documented. We know what she wore. I mean, I would say next to Jacqueline Kennedy, she is the most photographed American woman. And we have many, 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 many pictures of her. How many of you, are there any folks that met her or, oh, right on, tell a story, please.
I shook her hand when I was in college. She came to our university.
Really?
Yeah, I gave a lecture and then we got the receiving line afterwards. I got to shake her hand.
Oh, that's so exciting. Was she a good speaker?
Oh, yeah. I mean, she was an inspiring woman.
Yes. Very inspiring. And over here, yes.
Well, we were visiting Hyde Park when I was about 6 years old, and she pinched my sister's cheek or her thigh or whatever. And
really?
My parents turned and said, that was Eleanor.
Oh, my. Well, you're going to hear about Hyde Park today.
Okay.
How exciting. How many of you remember when you were alive hearing about her? What are your recollections?
Of that nigger lover.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Yes.
I was from the South.
Yes. Yes, that nigger lover, that's a, thank you so much. Other things you knew or remember, heard about?
She was a very strong-willed woman.
Yes.
And she was married to Roosevelt.
Right.
And,
Strong-willed and married to Roosevelt. Yes, sir.
Well, the fact that all the rumors, quote, of the affair that FDR was having and, you know, I remember my family saying, why would she stay with him, you know, and that sort of thing.
Well, my speech or my talk about her is very politic. I've done it in all places for lots of kids, too. So I think it was glossed over much of the way the media did it in those days.
Really?
If they were in the White House today, we would know far too much, more than we need to know. TMI, too much information. And yes, and there's lots of rumors about her. Do you know the rumors about her? Okay. Yeah. So I'm going to. This is a very G-rated. So, but if you get the three volume, you get all the love letters between. I mean, you get it all. And there's I think every year there's a new set of books about her. We are inspired by her as a country. Or there's been a new resurgence, maybe since Hillary. So I think that we're all here. I'm going to begin. I never wanted to become the president's wife. In fact, when Franklin won the election in 1932, I was deeply troubled. I dreaded the prospect of living in the White House. I was proud of my own accomplishments as a teacher, a writer, and in the political arena, and I feared that I would lose my hard-won independence in Washington, D.C. Could I have the life of my own? Or would my role be to greet guests and preside at formal dinner parties? I knew my concerns were pure selfishness on my own part, and I never mentioned my feelings to Franklin on the matter. So I did my duty. The White House bustled with visitors at tea, receptions, and dinners, and I seized the opportunity to transform the role of First Lady. I was very proud to make the White House more accessible to Americans by answering letters, visiting literally thousands of people, and letting them know that I cared for them. I became the first presidential wife to have a public life and a career. I insisted on my right to drive myself without a police escort or a chauffeur. And the Secret Service begged me to carry a pistol. I took it, and I learned how to use it. Now, I do not mean I'm an expert shot. I don't like guns. I only wish I knew something about them. My opportunities for shooting have been far and few between, but if necessary, I knew how to use a pistol. People say that I have come a long way from the timid and the shy child who was always afraid of something. I had many opportunities to travel as fact finder and troubleshooter for my husband, the president. Because his legs could not take him many places, mine took us many places. On these travels, I was an impassioned speaker for social justice and for world peace. Folks said that I was an inspiring speaker and that I seemed to give off light. I know that I had a fire in my belly about what was truly important, and I was going to use my voice. I believe that in spite of timidity and fear, in spite of lack of special talents, one can find a way to live widely and fully. But wait, let's go back. Let me tell you something about my childhood. I was born October 11, 1884, and my godfather was Uncle Theodore, who became the 26th President of the United States. They called me Granny, even as a little child. I was a quiet, old-fashioned, solemn, and painfully shy child. I was very much a disappointment to my mother, Anna. She was troubled by my lack of beauty, so she brought me up in a way that my manners might compensate for my looks. My father, Elliot, was a dashing sportsman who hunted tigers and lions in India. I adored him. He was gifted with a generous nature. He was tender, sympathetic, and manly. But when I look back on him, I realize he was also deeply troubled. He was nervous, and he was moody. He would go off on drinking sprees with his friends and come home reeking of liquor. But I also never doubted that I stood first in my father's heart. I loved his voice as he sang to the boatmen in Venice when we traveled there, and the way he treated me. My greatest wish in my whole life was to please my father. But because of his drinking and his carousing, my mother thought it better for him to be away from us for a 2-year probationary period. At that time, I did not understand why my father was away. No matter what I did, I could never earn my mother's approval. Just before I was 8, my mother entered the hospital to have surgery on some unknown illness. And after the surgery, she contracted diphtheria. And at the age of 29, my mother died. I can remember standing with my cousin Susie, and she told me that my mother was dead. Death meant nothing to me as an 8-year-old. All I knew was that father would be back soon. But in my mother's will, she asked that we not be raised by my father, but instead her mother, my grandmother Hall, in her gloomy Manhattan brownstone. But I look forward to all of my father's visits, and I harbored the belief that he would someday be together with me again. He told me to be a good girl, not to be any trouble, to study hard, and to grow up to be the woman that I could be proud of, and that he would soon come to see me whenever possible. But in truth, this is actually how I lived. I lived in a dream world where I was the heroine and my father the hero. Into this world I withdrew as soon as I went to bed and as soon as I woke up in the morning, every waking hour. And all the time I was walking, or when anyone bored me, which was quite frequently. Actually, my grandmother discouraged even short visits with my father because of his drinking. One day, my father lapsed into a coma after a drunken fall. And 1 year after my mother had died, my father died without any of his family around him. And after his death, I lived even more closely in my dream world. So, I was brought up by a strict grandmother who believed no was always a better answer than yes. As a result, I became a conscientious student, mastering arithmetic easily, loving poetry, and writing stories about lonely children who yearned for love. There are really not many bright spots in my growing up, although I had everything you could possibly ever want. After my father died, despite our wealth and our place in society, I did enjoy school, where I excelled, and I spent most of my summer in my favorite home overlooking the Hudson River. During those summer months, I would be lost in books and my own private dream world. Attention and admiration were the things I wanted, but I was made to believe that nothing would ever make me attractive or draw any attention to me as a person. So, during my 14th year, I went to our family's annual Christmas ball, which caused me more pain than pleasure. All my other cousins knew that well. I was dressed in a short dress with blue bows on each of my shoulders. I looked ridiculous. The other girls were dressed as sophisticated young ladies. I knew that I was different from all of them, and in case I hadn't known, they were made it plain in telling me so. But my life changed when I was 15, and I was sent off to England for my education. On the outskirts of London, Mademoiselle Sauvestier, a magnetic French woman in her 70s, greeted me. Now, most of the 35 students were English, but they were required to speak French at all times. The rules were strict at the school, which I was used to, but the atmosphere was charged with excitement. Mademoiselle challenged us to open our minds and imaginations and to think for ourselves. That was something new for me. I admired Mademoiselle so much. Her speech was brilliant. She darted here and there with agility and grace like a hummingbird. Every subject, however dull, she became animated when telling about it. Mademoiselle Sauvestier taught history and literature, which of course became my favorite subjects. For the first time in my life, I was making friends easily. People liked me. My headaches vanished, and I was never ill. I even stopped biting my nails. During school holidays, Mademoiselle Sauvestier invited me to join her on trips to France and Italy because I never wanted to go home to America. We stayed in small hotels and we saw a few foreigners. We ate local food and we went off the beaten track and we changed plans at the spur of the moment. One night, I'll never forget, we got off the train in the middle of the night. She said, "Leave your bags here, Eleanor." So I did. And she said, "Take off your shoes." Take off my shoes? And I did it. And we walked along the Mediterranean Sea barefoot in the middle of the night. Never again would I be that rigid little person I had been before. The 3 years at the school in England were the happiest in my life. I wanted to stay a fourth year, but Grandmother Hall summoned me back to America to make my formal debut in New York society. Mademoiselle Sauvestier worried about me coming back to the States. I knew that her liberal mind and her strong personality had changed my life. When I returned to New York, Mademoiselle said that she would miss me every day of her life. As you might suspect, I had terrors about my social debut. I still thought about those blue ribbons on my shoulders. The ball was to be held at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel 2 months after my 18th birthday. I felt as though I would never measure up to what a Roosevelt or a Hall woman was expected to be. On the evening of my assembly ball, I wore a gown that my aunt had ordered from Paris. My hair was artfully arranged in the latest style, but even in this outfit, I felt that I was too tall, too serious, and way too plain. I went home early after the ball, thankful to get away. I felt as though my debut was a flop. Although that winter, I did get many invitations to parties and to socials. I'd grown up considerably during the year of my debutante parties, and I'd come to the conclusion that I did not like being around those social balls and parties. But there was a group of young social women who were eager to do something helpful to the city. They volunteered for active work in the slums, and so I joined. At first, the streets were crowded with foreign-looking people, filled me with terror. But the children interested me enormously. I entered my first sweatshop, and I walked up the steps of my first tenement, and I saw the children of age 4 or 5 working until they dropped with fatigue. And I did what I could to help as a volunteer worker, and I became quite enthusiastic about it. But I was also looking forward to a summer because I had been seeing a particular young man from Harvard who was even taller than I was, if you can believe it. He'd asked for my hand in marriage, and secretly, we were engaged. I had seen the young man while riding on the train to our country house. He was my cousin, actually fifth cousin once removed, so pretty far unrelated. I guess Franklin had remembered me as the skinny girl in that hopeless party dress with the blue bows on my shoulders. But I continued to run into Franklin during the winter of my debut. Since my uncle and godfather, Theodore, was now the president, we went to some social gatherings at the White House, and I got to see Franklin. Franklin had invited me to the weekend to those parties that he has in the summer in his cottage off Maine. We took muddy walks along the cliffs together. Of course, Franklin and I were never alone together. That would have been highly improper for our Victorian day. A third person was always a chaperone. It was understood that no girl interested in a man or showed interest in him made any advances at all. You knew a man very well before you wrote or received a letter from him, and you never allowed a man to give you a present except perhaps flowers or candy or possibly a good book. To receive a piece of jewelry from a man to whom you were not engaged was a sign of being an indecent woman. And the idea that you would permit a man to kiss you before you engaged never entered my mind. I hear things have changed a bit today. When Franklin asked me to marry him, he told me that with my help, he was sure that he would amount to something someday. I responded, "Why me? I am plain. I have little to bring you." But Franklin's earnest and persuasive manner persuaded me and convinced me that I could stand beside him and bring out the best in him, and that my sense of purpose could steady his course during the years ahead. Of course, given my childhood, someone who loved me and believed in me and thought that I had things to admire appealed to me greatly. When dear Franklin shared the news with his mother, Sarah, he exclaimed, "I am the happiest man just now in all the world, luck and all, likewise the luckiest." Franklin wrote to me, "You are never out of my thoughts, dear, for one moment. Everything has changed for me now. I am so happy, oh, so happy, and I love you so dearly." Sarah, who later became quite an obstacle, was stunned. She was not ready to give up her son in marriage. We kept our engagement a secret while Franklin finished his final year at Harvard. In public, we needed to be quite careful. But in our private letters, we could express ourselves freely, and we did. Then we made our public engagement. I asked my Uncle Ted, President Roosevelt, if he would stand up for me as my father at the wedding and present me. Uncle Teddy replied that he would be delighted, is how he said. We decided on St. Patrick's Day, March 17th, 1905. Since the president was going to be at a parade in New York City anyway. Our wedding day took place in a candlelit room of Cousin Susie's townhouse under a bower of palms and pink roses when my uncle kissed me and turned to my groom saying, Well, Franklin, there's nothing like keeping the name in the family. For our honeymoon, we were elated to take a 3-month visit to Europe. Now, after graduating from Harvard, Franklin enrolled in Columbia Law School, New York City. And while we were away on our honeymoon, his mother, Sarah, rented us a townhouse. She furnished it herself. She hired my cook, a butler, and a maid. My mother-in-law was more than a little bit involved in my life. Can any of you relate to that? The following spring, our first baby, Anna Eleanor, was born. She was named for her mother and grandmother. Now, for the next 10 years, I remember either getting over or having a baby the entire time. Franklin finished law school, passed the bar exam, and joined a Wall Street law firm. At my mother-in-law's insistence, I gave up my volunteer work. She said this, "I had no right to go to the slums or hospitals for fear of bringing diseases home to our family." So, at the birth of James, our second baby, my mother-in-law gave us an either larger home, right next to hers. Yeah. One evening, Franklin came home to find me in our bedroom weeping. I told my bewildered husband that I didn't like living in a house that wasn't mine in any way, and that one I had done nothing about and didn't represent my life in any way. He told me that I was quite mad and that I would feel better in a while. And he left the room. Our third child, Franklin Jr., was born in 1909. He was the biggest and the most beautiful of all my babies. At 7 months, little baby Franklin contracted a flu and died. I blamed myself. I thought that I'd not care for him well enough, and I made myself and all those around me most unhappy for the next year. 10 months after my baby's death, another son, Elliot, was born. During our first years of marriage, Franklin and I realized that we were very different in ways that mattered to us both. Duty became a motivating force in my life, often excluding what might have been joy or pleasure. I made choices in my life based on what I ought to do, not on what I wanted to do. I was never carefree. I hear things have changed for women today. I was becoming interested in human beings. I learned that nearly everyone had something interesting to contribute to my education. Franklin was campaigning for the New York State Senator in Albany, and I am embarrassed to say that I believe politics was a man's world. Even though Franklin came out in favor of the women's right to vote, I was shocked at that. Then I took for granted that men were superior creatures, knowing that more about politics than women did. Since only men made the rules and played the games, perhaps that was true in a way. I fear that my children recall their young years with me making lots of arrangements for them and not sharing in their days of fun, such as skating and sledding. It wasn't until I was much older that I was any fun at all, I am sorry to say. On April 16, 1917, America entered World War I and was an ally of Britain and France. Combat troops were whipped overseas to Europe. From then on, Franklin, as a state senator, and other men in government worked from early morning late into the night. There were nights when he would sleep just 1 or 2 hours. Millions of women rallied to the war effort, and I volunteered along with 70,000 women on the Red Cross. My long-missed volunteer work brought deep satisfaction. I loved taking on responsibilities outside of my home. I loved it. I simply devoured it. Others called me a dynamo. I was learning a certain confidence in myself I'd never known before. I would meet emergencies and I dealt with them. And then one day I found Lucy Mercer's love letters to Franklin. I had the sinking feeling that I would never be the same. I felt that after 13 years of marriage and 6 children, Franklin had discarded me for a younger, more attractive woman. But in those days, the idea of divorce was purely scandalous. Our dear friend and our advisor, whose name was Louis Howe, pleaded with me to think of the children and to forgive my husband. In the end, Franklin and I agreed to hold our marriage together as friends. Though we were reconciled, our relationship had changed forever. It became more of a working partnership than a marriage, a close and affectionate partnership. The 1920 election was the first in which women could vote. Franklin ran as the vice president candidate with James Cox. Suddenly, a candidate's wife was important for the first time, and Franklin wanted me at his side. I was at his coattails at every whistle stop as we toured the country by train, campaigning in every little town. I think I've been in every small town in America. But Mr. Cox and Franklin lost the election, and for the first time in a decade, Franklin was not in public life. I had made up my mind that I wanted to become more independent. So I became involved in the League of Women Voters, which was founded by veterans of the long battle for the right of the women to vote. In my volunteer work with the League, I made lifelong beloved friends that were brilliant, powerful, and dynamic. These women gave me an intensive education over the next years. They were so different from conventional society matrons I had known. My mother-in-law, Sarah, was distressed by my involvement, which made me love it all the more. But I had long ceased to be dependent or dominated by my mother-in-law. I was finally thinking for myself and becoming an individual. One day, in the summer of 1921, we were on vacation. Franklin went for a swim and then went to bed early with a chill. He awoke the next morning with a high fever and stabbing pains and a spreading paralysis. Soon he could not stand up, nor could he move his legs. We had doctors look at him, and finally a specialist came to the house and he diagnosed polio. Franklin, from then on, was paralyzed from the waist down. He lay in the room with his shades down, wondering if he would ever walk again. And I was worried sick. I slept on the couch right next to him, nursing him day and night. Those early days of Franklin healing, much of my hurt and resentment gave way to tenderness and compassion for my suffering husband. But I refused to treat Franklin as an invalid. In essence, I became his legs from then on, going places he could no longer go. In fact, Franklin's illnesses gave me the courage to stand on my own 2 feet in regard to my husband's life, my own life, and our children's training. Louis Howe, our dear friend and political advisor, urged me to become Franklin's stand-in to keep the Roosevelt name in the public eye, while Franklin concentrated on his recovery. I joined the newly organized New York State Women's Division of the Democratic Party. I loved meeting people, but at first I was terrified at public speaking. Louis coached me. I worked on women's groups all over the state, and I became close friends with the female movers and shakers, women leaders from all around New York. We got together and purchased land around Valkill Creek, and we built a cottage there where we could go and work and live from time to time. Franklin sympathized with my wish to become more independent. The big house in town was really my mother-in-law's domain, but I loved the cottage at the creek, where the peace and quiet was divine. I would have loved Holden Village. We even made swimming in the hole at Valkill where Franklin could exercise his legs in private where there were not people to take pictures. I also had time to be both mother and father to our children, because Franklin was constantly away seeking a cure for his paralysis. In 1928, Franklin made his return to politics, where he won the election to be the governor of New York State. I will admit that I have mixed feelings about my new role as First Lady of the state. I was also very active in politics and as co-director of the Democratic National Women's Committee. I continued the teaching I'd begun in New York City, commuting between there to the governor's house in Albany. Franklin sought my advice on matters. He encouraged my involvement in political functions, and we both spoke extensively. I went on many official gatherings, acting as Franklin's eyes, ears, and legs. I refused to ride in a limousine, and instead I drove myself in my own car. I was very busy with teaching of literature, drama, and the American history at Todd Hunter School in Manhattan. I also begun a furniture, I'd begun a furniture factory with my dear friends at Valkill. I was rather busy. During Franklin's first term as governor, the United States went from boom to bust literally overnight. In October 1929, the stock market crashed. Millions of people lost money, lost their jobs. Factories were closed and businesses failed. As head of an industrial state, Franklin took bold measures to provide jobs for unemployed and relief for the needy. In 1930, he was reelected to the biggest margin ever recorded in New York State history. This landslide made him a front runner for the U.S. presidential nomination in 1932. And so I wondered, and I worried whether in Washington, D.C. I could keep up with my own career as teacher and businesswoman. And on the campaign trail for presidency, one reporter described me as gracious, charming, patient, and serene. Clearly the devoted helpmate. The public could not have guessed that actually I dreaded going to the White House. So on election day, Franklin overwhelmingly defeated his Republican opponent, President Herbert Hoover. That night, I faced the glare of newsreel camera lights, doing my best to smile. I had to force it. I was miserable. But on the train ride back to Albany, I decided that I would be unlike previous first ladies. Throwing parties, smiling, and being the nation's hostess, I was going to make a new role for the First Lady. When we entered the White House on March 4th, 1933, the Great Depression was in its fourth destructive year. One third of working people in America had lost their jobs and could not find work. Thousands of banks had failed, wiping out people's total savings. In our great cities, hunger and homeless Americans stood in line for soup and dug through garbage cans looking for food. Not since 1861, when Abraham Lincoln faced the nation torn over slavery, had there been such a national crisis. The White House staff was shocked by my informality. I always pitched in to help. Even when they moved furniture around, I would move a couch. I wasn't above that. I insisted on running the elevator myself, sometimes shadowed by Secret Service men. No one's going to hurt me, I said. I simply can't be afraid of going around America, as I always have been, and I always will. My resolve was to stay in touch with ordinary Americans. One day, I was driving with Louis Howe. I got out of the car. I walked over to some men waiting in a food line. They looked at me curiously, asking my name and what I wanted. I told them who I was, and I just wanted to see how they were getting along. When I got back into the car, all the folks waved and wished me good luck. I waved back and wished them good luck. This was the role I was used to, but it was very new for the First Lady. I went everywhere. Since I could travel more freely than the President, I did. I dropped in on coal miners in the Appalachian Mountains, and I went down the mine in one of those little trains. I went to see slum dwellers in Puerto Rico and sharecroppers who lived in tar paper shacks in the cotton fields. I had a memorable tea in one of those tar paper shacks that I will never forget. I inspected government relief projects from one end of the country to the other. Often I arrived in advance without them being polished for my inspection. I believe that my thousands of visits created the feeling that Americans, that the First Lady cared about them, because I did. I'd been writing about my travels since the 20s, and I now began a column, which was called My Day. How many of you ever have seen that or read it in the newspaper? Wonderful. In which I reported on my visits and my life in the White House. I wrote each and every word myself. I had no aide do it for me. One nice writer said that the image of the First Lady was changing to friendly, unpretentious, possessing unlimited energy, and a broad interest for all sorts of people and a sincere wish for the human welfare. I quite like that. People liked the way I handled questions in a calm manner, including those meant to embarrass me. One hostile questioner asked, "Do you think your husband's illness has affected his mentality?" And I answered quickly, "I am glad you asked the question. The answer is yes. Anyone who has gone through great suffering is bound to have greater sympathy and understanding of others' problems." I used my lectures, my radio show, and my daily columns and press conferences and endless travels through America to publicize my views on social justice and help bring the White House closer to the American people. I spoke out for the weak and the disadvantaged, blacks and other minorities, for the poor farmers, the unemployed, the hungry, and the homeless, for those who had no public platform, no spokesperson on their own. My focus was not only on jobless men, but also jobless women. 2 million previously employed women were now out of work, and I organized a conference to give them support. The New Deal, Franklin's programs to get the country out of the Depression, were labeled liberal, wasteful, and socialistic by Republican detractors. But we believe that an enlightened and caring government, a government truly of, by, and for all the American people, could and should solve the devastating crisis. That we Americans must act to bring about a more humane and just society. I had grown up with black people surrounding me, but mostly as servants, I'm sorry to say. In the White House, I spoke out for all civil rights, the rights of all people. One time in Alabama, they had me come and speak. And they literally had the whites sit on this side, and then there was an aisle, and the blacks sit on this side. And I was asked to take a seat with the whites, but I refused. So I just took my chair, smiling, and put it in the center of the aisle, and sat there for the remainder of the time. The Daughters of the American Revolution, or the DAR, organization exists today. They once denied Marian Anderson, a celebrated black singer, the opportunity to sing at the Constitution Hall at one of their big meetings because she was black. I was outraged by the decision, and I resigned from the DAR, which focused worldwide attention on the situation. Then I scheduled a free open-air concert by Marian to perform on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. An enormous crowd of 75,000 people gathered to hear my friend Marian and her magnificent contralto voice as she sang America the Beautiful and Nobody Knows the Troubles I've Seen, a great traditional Negro spiritual sung in the Underground Railroad. I made several enemies by taking that stand. They called me a meddlesome busybody, a do-gooder, a nigger lover, a woman who didn't know her own place. One critic said, "I wish Mrs. Roosevelt would stick to her knitting and keep out of national affairs." My response was clear. Everyone must live her own life in the way that they must, not according to anyone else's ideas. Well, when Franklin ran for a second term, I went along the campaign trail again. If I failed to appear on the platform with him, the crowd cheered until I appeared. Many Americans knew I was for them, and he won re-election by 11 million votes, the largest margin in history. Throughout Franklin's presidential years, he and I observed a ritual. When I returned home from a trip, we would dine informally, just the two of us. And I would report on my impressions and my thoughts from my trip while they were still fresh. We spoke openly and frankly. I believe that we were a solid, effective team. We were very fine partners. I am the agitator, and he was the politician. Some called me the conscience of the New Deal. A typical day at home might include a morning press conference, lunch with the wives of cabinet members, an afternoon appearance or benefit, and a formal state dinner. Before retiring, I would go into Franklin's room to say goodnight. That was one of the few times we could be alone and talk, and then I would return to my room and go to sleep. As we continued our active roles in American life, Franklin had to turn his attention to World War II. He finally had to send troops to fight in both Europe and the South Pacific when the Japanese attacked our Navy in Hawaii in late 1941. I was very disappointed because I had worked to keep us neutral and for peace in Europe. I had appealed for disarmament by the warring nations. However, I also became appalled by the brutality of the war and told my readers that I am not neutral in feeling, as I believe in democracy and the right of a people to choose their own government without having it imposed on them by Hitler or Mussolini. Beginning in 1942, I traveled to much of war-torn Europe and the South Pacific, and I visited wounded American soldiers all over the world. The generals and admirals became some of my strongest supporters. Franklin was elected to a record fourth term in 1944 as he worked to end the war with Germany and Japan. He worked with Winston Churchill, Prime Minister of England, and other world leaders to stop the massive war. But he died before the war was over in April 1945. After I was done being First Lady of America, some said I became First Lady of the world. I was elected in 1946 chairman of the UN Human Rights Commission, and I helped draft the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. In 1961, I returned from the UN General Assembly, and President John F. Kennedy appointed me to the head of the Commission on the Status of Women. Not long afterward, I died in 1963. I lived a full and public life. I was most grateful to be of service. I had the opportunity to meet amazing and inspiring people like Helen Keller. Helen Keller said, "Life is either a daring adventure or nothing at all," and I must say my life was a daring adventure. Thank you for letting me tell you about my story. I hope that my story might help you live your life with passion and courage. The end. I'm not an expert, but maybe there are some others in the room. Are there questions about Eleanor Roosevelt? Yes, sir.
Just when she was doing that work and being criticized by the others, did Franklin support her openly?
I'm going to look to my helpers here for this. I think he did, but he was quite a political being. He didn't want to ruffle some feathers.
Well, one of the things I love that I remember is Franklin, she would write all these columns and say all these horribly liberal things, and he'd say, "Well, I just can't deal with my wife," or, something on that order. Eleanor.
Right.
He sort of had both best of both.
A bit like Gore handled Clinton in his it was a bit like that, I think. Yes. Yes. Any other questions?
I have another one.
Yes.
I may.
Good, please.
listening to Judy and the Holocaust, during that period of time, the Jewish people that were trying to come in were not allowed in. Were they involved in that?
Oh, yeah.
Decision.
Eleanor worked very hard for the Jews, and she was furious
she,
with
she wanted
husband.
Them to come she, in if they
she worked
to
very, very hard on that, and okay. was absolutely upset. You know, Franklin was being pushed a lot, but for some reason, I guess he thought he couldn't do it.
Yeah. She spoke out on every topic you could speak out on. And I have read that when Hillary took all the flack she did for the years she was in the White House, the person she would look to was Eleanor, not just for the stands Eleanor took, for how Eleanor handled all the criticism. It wasn't as ugly, in my opinion, as Hillary got, but she was called some very ugly things. Nigger lover is not a very lovely thing to be called, and the people that said that just had so much hate. Eleanor was far more courageous than her husband. I don't know if he ever would have been reelected had it not been for her. She was so compassionate and outspoken. I mean, even if you had disagreed with her, you respected her. And I think sometimes, I'm speaking here as Catherine Cummings Bond, I think people think that you have to be all things to all people, but I don't believe that. I think if you take a stand, even if people disagree with you, they respect taking a stand. And maybe that's where the president these days is not having as much, because he's not taking terribly many stands. I've just spoken as Catherine and not Eleanor, so. So hard not to say. Thank you for coming. I know it was a lot of history, and many of you have lived through that history, but thank you for taking in the sojourn with Eleanor Roosevelt. She was not a woman of faith. If you notice, there wasn't a word said about faith, but she certainly acted on Matthew 25 about feeding the hungry. I mean, she changed American history by helping and standing up for people. And there is, of course, you should know, a big flap about her being lesbian and about letters between she and many and a couple women. So that's just FYI. I don't know. I did not know Eleanor, but there's if you want to read more on her, everything that is written about her is just fascinating. And again, she's one of these people who just makes us better firemen, better teachers, better chimney sweeps. Whatever it is we do to take on an Eleanor Roosevelt makes you stand taller. So thank you for coming today to hear about her.
Oh, definitely.